Well, thank you very much, Lynn. I'm very grateful to the directors of the conference to have invited me to come here, in particular to Dr. Hyesung Jang, if I pronounce correctly, I'm not sure. He wrote to me, I think 2 or 3 months ago, and he said, I have looked on your webpage, and on the webpage I saw a talk which we would like to have here. I was a little bit surprised, because this was a talk not for a scientific audience. I have changed it a little bit. I guess put a little more science into it, but I have to apologize, particular to my friends from biology, because it's a very low level as far as the biology is concerned. The title, Life, a Result of Evolution or Design, has a kind of peculiar history. I'm going into it in a second. I will give you the webpage where Hyesung has found the talk and where I put all my talks. Also, I've learned already it's very risky if you put all your talks on the webpage for 2 reasons. The administrative people see how many lectures you are giving and how much you are traveling, and your colleagues see how redundant your talks are. So everybody who does this is presumably aware of the risk. The whole story started in 2005 when the Viennese Cardinal Christoph Schönborn wrote a commentary in the New York Times where he accused scientists who work on evolution of an ideology. So they said, this is all ideology, you have to be open, you have to be open to creation, intelligent design, and so on. And this caused me to answer in the journal Complexity, and I wrote a column on that, and I said, well, if there is an ideology in evolution, it is the ideology of science in a way that we don't believe things unless they are verified by empirical facts. And so a discussion started. The discussion actually was quite pleasant. I think also Cardinal Schönborn actually changed his mind to a certain extent. And then I was invited in 2006 to attend a meeting in Castel Gandolfo here in Italy near Rome, where the Pope Benedict XVI was present and was discussing this issue. A book came out, and there is also an English translation of this book available. So this is more or less the reason why I became involved in this subject, and as some of you know, we were doing models for evolution on a very, very simple and primitive level. I don't say that from these models you can really conclude how evolution was taking place in biology, but you see some principles, and as physicists like to see the world, these principles are well aware already in these simple systems. So what I'm going to do here today, I will give you a very short introduction and the points which are raised in evolution on the organismic and molecular level, and try to give you some evidence that evolution is a real subject, and I think there are few people in the audience who really will question that. And then I come to the basic processes, multiplication, mutation, selection. Then say a few words about rational design. A very simple example I give you, we can do, and protein people know this very well, to a certain extent we can do rational design. Then I will speak a little bit about our own work on evolution and optimization of molecules. Want to digress into biological complexity if time is available. And then Hyesung asked me at the end to put my chapter on probabilities. Probabilities in biology, because this is in a way guiding over to the conference, because I shall use, for instance, the notions of landscapes for proteins and so on. Now, let me start with evolution. The biologists talk about genotypes, the molecular biologists talk about genomes, and before knowledge from the molecular issues, genome was considered to be a collection of genes, and I shall come back at the end to the problem of notion of gene. Now, the genotype unfolds to produce a phenotype, and for this there is a developmental program necessary, and does it in the higher organisms. In lower level and lower organisms, it's organized a little bit differently, and what you need is highly specific environmental conditions. If you put genes somewhere in water, they would do nothing. So you need highly specific environmental conditions, and we come back to this in a second. And what you get then, you come to the concept of evolution, which I will go into detail then in a minute. And evolution explains the origin of species and can also explain the interactions between species. And now you have the enormous diversity. These are prokaryotes, bacteria. Here you have plants. Here you have mushrooms. And here you have animals. All this diversity is created in this way. Now, we do the same thing now with the eyes of molecular biology. What we have learned is there is a message written in DNA, and this message is the genome. We have a number of sequences. This is unfolded into the phenotype, and again, you need a highly specific environmental conditions. But there are some things peculiar, because you can take a mammalian gene, as you know, and express it in bacteria. So you need this environment for expressing the DNA, but there is one important issue, and this is also important for philosophical aspects. The genetic machinery is almost always the same from bacteria to human, otherwise we couldn't express human insulin in bacteria. I come back to this. And then there is really a whole explosion of different fields, biochemistry, molecular biology, structural biology, and so on. And more recently, we understand on the molecular level epigenetics, where RNA is involved, and all this. And we have these different areas, and others will come and will be added to that, which give us our understanding of this unfolding of the genotype, which turns out to be a complicated thing, but understandable, at least as many of us believe on the molecular level. And this is the history. The first time when people saw, made a proposal of a structure for a molecule and could immediately deduce the function that was, as you all know, DNA. And it was the start of molecular biology. A little later, almost the same time, people revealed the structure of proteins and started to understand the function of proteins by means of molecular structure. Making or determining protein sequences was not such an easy task at the beginning. And for me, when I looked into the history of hemoglobin, it was very interesting that the three-dimensional structure and the full amino acid sequence were determined at the same time, and Max Perutz, John Kendrew, and Gerhard Braunitzer were exchanging their results and helped each other. Now then, molecular evolution on different level, first by Linus Pauling, and then continued by Emil Zuckerkandl, and also Manfred Eigen worked in this area to understand evolution as a chemical process. And just let me mention this exciting RNA story. When I was a student, I was told RNA is a dull molecule. It's the working copy, which is read off the DNA, because DNA is much too precious and you won't destroy it in the molecular reactions. Now we know that RNA, and I will say one word later, is one of the major regulators, presumably, higher organisms and particular mammals. And when now people talk about quantitative biology, and when you look carefully what they are doing, I would say the new biology is the chemistry of the living matter, but without taking away from biology the unique issues. Now let's say a few words about Charles Darwin. When he was talking about evolution, he had two things in mind. First of all, multiplication, and here he was influenced by the Scottish economists and the English economists this was the 17th century, when they were talking about the problem, multiplication, growth of population, and problems related to it. And then he was postulating variation, which is a very interesting feature, because he was not aware of a correct mechanism of inheritance. So variation in Darwin's Origin of Species is a postulate for which he has empirical evidence. And he has the empirical evidence from animal breeders who are able to vary the animals when they do their breeding. And finally, selection, which is a result of a finite world anyway. Variation, and this is one of the tricks of evolution, variation through mutation and recombination operates only on the genotype. And the phenotype is the target of selection. Now, this was true until recently, when one started to understand epigenetics, and the epigenetic mechanism is a little bit influencing this strict statement, because you can also have variation on the phenotype because of epigenetics, and as Sidney Brenner recently said in a talk, I am not puzzled by epigenetics, because what's epigenetics then a funny kind of enzymology with special properties, where the genetic informations of previous generation can also come into the development. So, and for the simple systems I'm talking about, this is precisely true. There is one important property of the Darwinian scenario, and this is variation in the form of mutation and recombination events occur uncorrelated with their effect on the selection process. That means a mutation occurs by a specific mechanism of mutation with a certain probability. No matter whether it causes an advantage for the carrier or a disadvantage or has no influence at all, we shall see that neutrality also plays an important role. And then if you consider these three conditions, there is no reason to believe that you can't fulfill it with molecules. Nucleic acid molecules can multiply, vary, and there should be possible to do experiments in cell-free assays. I'll come to this a little later. There is only one figure in Charles Darwin's book, and this concerns the tree of life, the phylogenetic tree, where species develop in time, some of them die out, others are split into branches, and so on. This is the only drawing, and Charles Darwin says one thing more, which is not stressed so much, but which turned out to be correct, that this tree has one root. It comes from a common ancestor, and I'll come back to this in a second. In the early 20th century, then people have reconstructed from morphology, comparing the different organisms, the tree of life. So you see here one, I took it from the book by Lynn Margulis called Five Kingdoms, and this tree was reconstructed in such a way that also fossils were included from paleontology, and there you could also derive Fula. They were no longer existence, they had died out over the years. Now, I said the discovery of Watson Crick that DNA is a double helix was really a really fundamental insight, because if you have a DNA molecule, this four-letter alphabet, there is a unique way to make a duplex, and this way you make a duplex, you doubled already the information which is stored in this molecule. So this process showed, and it was correctly interpreted already at the very beginning, how information can be reproduced, can be duplicated in biology. Here you see it for DNA, and if you study organisms, you see immediately what, of course, Charles Darwin couldn't know, how variation comes into play. That's first of all point mutation, so you change a single digit here in the message, and this occurs quite often, and it occurs in a natural way because the incorporation of wrong bases of point mutations, these are parallel reactions to the correct replication of this digit. They have a certain probability, some are more probable, some are less probable, and nowadays you can actually play with this mutation rate. Mutation is an insertion, here shown for four letters, which are duplicated twice in the copy here. And if I have time, I will show you one of these huge duplications where a whole genome has been duplicated for yeast, for example. And then deletions occur, also quite frequent variations of a genetic information. And then, it's hard to read, but I can tell you what's on that slide. You start with a certain sequence, and you introduce, and I used here only point mutation, you introduce variations. And some of these sequences, they have progeny, so they propagate first, or others don't, and then you end up with a present-day collection of sequences. And now, what the people over the years have tried, and in most cases they can be successful, from these information, from these sequences, you can derive the tree. The tree with which you arrived at the present-day sequences. There are certain problems that cannot be decided, for instance, in this way. That's one example, is where the root is. You have to assume a root, because the root can be somewhere else on the tree. And in principle, if you don't know the times, and usually if you look on present-day sequences, you can't know the times along the timescale. You don't know where the root is. But these things, really, I needn't tell you that, have been carefully analyzed. And so the really, for me, one of the best evidence we have for evolution as a historical fact is that this tree, which you construct from sequences, from present-day sequences, this tree is practically identical. Of course, there are some minor uncertainties, but it's practically identical with the tree that has been derived from morphologies and from fossils. So let me summarize here two results. One is The molecular machinery of all present-day cells are very similar and provide a strong hint that all life on Earth descended from one common ancestor. And this common ancestor, if you look, for instance, in the worldwide net, the internet, is called LUCA. There's a small little text called "My name is Luca." You can look at it, and it stands for Last Universal Common Ancestor. And the second thing which we should memorize here, or should keep in mind, is comparison of DNA sequences from best present-day organisms allows for the reconstruction of phylogenetic trees, which are the same as those derived from morphological comparison of species and the paleontological record of fossils. And I've mentioned already this common molecular machinery is used nowadays in genetic engineering, and this is the most direct proof that it's really very similar machinery. I come to my next part, which is multiplication, mutation, and selection. This is, as I said, the genetic theory that was developed in the 70s. It became fashionable again. Many people refer now to these old papers, and this had also caused me to see what we can do nowadays. I will come back to it in one particular case. With modern computers, we can actually answer many of the questions that we could not treat numerically in those days. And the idea is, when you look on evolution of molecules, you have a reactor. And as I said, there is no reason why Darwinian evolution should not take place in such an assay. The molecules have to be able to replicate. This usually you do with an enzyme. For DNA, it can be, for instance, the DAC polymerase. For RNA, it's one of the virus enzymes, which are commonly used for this replication. You have the activated monomers, and you have a proper solution, and you look what's going on. Now we know two mechanisms. The DNA replication mechanism is quite complicated. It needs, as you all know, about 20 enzymes. And if you use a different, much more simpler mechanism where you just have one strand and make a double strand out of it, like with DAC polymerase, if you want to do direct research on the fork mechanism of DNA replication, it's complicated. No people have done this so far in the test tube because such a replication assay is so complicated. And if you go to the other mechanism that we know, the plus-minus mechanism of RNA, you have a plus strand, you synthesize a minus strand, you have the duplex, and then you dissociate the duplex and you continue. This is much easier. You can do it with a single enzyme. Now, people have also tried to do it without enzymes. It works without enzymes. However, you have a problem. And the problem is related to duplex dissociation. Because such a duplex is very stable. And if you make, for instance, 20, 30, 100 nucleotide long, such a D won't dissociate anymore. You have to boil it under pressure, for instance, or things like that, to be able to dissociate. And here is where the enzyme comes into play. During the replication process, the enzyme separates both strands so that the two strands, the plus strand and the newly synthesized minus strand here, form their secondary structures. And now two molecules with their secondary structures are unlikely, happens once in a while, but unlikely to form a duplex. So you avoid duplex formation by splitting the duplex when it contains only a few base pairs, where this is thermodynamically favorable. Well, you can say, well, this is plus-minus replication, and the other is direct replication, so these are two different stories. And with pencil and paper, you can make a nice computation. You set up the kinetic equation for complementary replication, then you play a little bit with mathematics, and finally, what you find is there are two modes of the system. The first mode is one which dies out because it has a negative exponential, as you see here. And this is the weighted difference between the plus and minus strength. And then there is a weighted sum of the plus and minus strength, and this grows exponentially. So despite the fact that plus strength replication and minus strength replication are independent events, by the dynamics of the plus-minus replication, they grow like an ensemble. And if you are interested in the details, they grow like the square roots, the inverse square roots of the replication constant. This is the relative concentration in here. Now, this is just to show you how replication errors occur, and in many RNA-based system, the replacement of an A by a G, which comes from a wrong incorporation of a G opposed to a U, is one of the most frequent mutations. And the reason is that in RNA, we shall see this in a minute again, with structure formation in RNA, the GU, wobble, base pair, fits almost perfectly into the double helix. Whereas in DNA, this is not the case. So this common mutation here in RNA is not found in DNA, and you can see it when you compare mutations in RNA viruses with those in DNA viruses. Now you can set up, this I said already, the correct replication is one reaction, and mutant formation gives you a spectrum of different mutants. You can actually, and this is what we did in the 80s, we looked on how we can solve the problem for very large dimension, for very large numbers of possible mutants. And what we did is what physicists do very often. You say one is my fittest variant, and then you do a mean field approximation. All the others are the same. And in that case, you can solve the problem. And that's what Jörg Swetin and I did in the 80s, and you get an answer which says there is a certain regime where you can have errors with increasing error rates, and this is my best sequence, and these are all the one error variants, all the two error variants, and there is a sharply defined error threshold. If I increase the mutation rate above, there is no inheritance anymore. And it turned out that this is quite a useful concept. And as I said, we were now able to extend this. This was our own landscape. Now we can also handle landscapes where all the other replication rates are different. And I briefly show you the result. This is the one error case for all being equal. And this is the one error case. These are the two error variants for if they have a certain spectrum of replication rate constants. And if you increase this spectrum, you get these larger values. But the error threshold is not affected by it. This is something that I was doing recently because we have now computers where you can treat all these problems with on landscapes which are close to reality. So this is the scenario that we actually have here. We have an accuracy limit of replication. No replication can operate with ultimate accuracy. So you have a certain error rate or mutation rate, which is determined by your mechanism. And the evolution is a kind of, if you want, success story to make replication more and more accurate. From small pieces of RNA, as we see it now in viruses, to DNA, where we have an increase in the accuracy of three orders of magnitude, and then to higher organisms, again an increase to several orders of magnitude, approximately 1 in 10 to the 9 Ditcher, this is wrong in human reproduction. And this is an enormous accuracy. It's like you have a library of a couple of thousand volumes and you copy the library and make just one error. So it's really an enormous accuracy that has been achieved here. Now, here we have the mutants. The mutants in some get more and more, and then you come to an error threshold, and we have called it quasi species. What's happening in here, and you can do experiments and show what these quasi species are like, and can check the kinetic theory, which turns out to be for large mutation rates quite useful. And then there is a practical application. Most of our viruses operate close to this error threshold, and various chemicals are used to drive this virus population across error threshold. Then if you increase the error rate, then the whole inheritance breaks down, and you can be cured from virus infection. This has been also summarized in a book edited by Esteban Domingo, Colin Parrish, and John Holland on origin and evolution of viruses, and they in particular concentrate in several chapters on this problem of accuracy of replication. Now let me summarize what we can actually get from the kinetic theory of molecular evolution. First, replicating ensembles of molecules form stationary populations called quasi-species, and they represent the genetic reservoir of sexually reproducing species. You don't need cells for that, you can do it in cell-free media. For stable inheritance, the genetic information requires mutation rates that must not exceed a precisely defined and computable error threshold. And finally, you can exploit these error thresholds for the development of novel antiviral strategies. Now, and this is an example which is not designed for biologists, but for a very general audience. I show you how rational design of molecule works. And for this, we use an RNA molecule. This is the chemical structure of an RNA molecule. Looks quite complicated, but isn't. It has a periodic backbone, which consists of ribose and phosphate moieties. There are counterions on either. They play a role in structure. Not going into details here. But fortunately enough, what you need are only the digits here to understand the molecule, and what I have shown here. This is the sequence of tRNA where I have removed all the modified bases. And if you look on the structure, there is an intermediate structure, the so-called secondary structure. And the nice thing about the secondary structure is it follows the same Watson-Crick type base pairing principle, with one exception I will mention pretty soon. And the molecule informing the structure folds back on itself by forming double helices. And a lot of work has been investigated to understand how this molecule forms now a three-dimensional structure. And a little bit in contrast to proteins, there seems to be a finite repertoire of tertiary motifs. And one of these tertiary motifs, for instance, is that helices stack upon themselves, and in this case here, to give you the L shape, this helix and this helix together form a long helix with the same axis. It's called coaxial stacking. What you see here, this is this part of the molecule here, and these two fold on themselves and give you this part. And then I would say there are about 30 of these motifs known for three-dimensional RNA structure. So the situation, like many people in this field, like Eric Westhoff, they believe that one day we can predict from sequence and secondary structure, the tertiary structure, because the number of possible motifs is finite. I come back to the secondary structure, and it has one advantageous feature. For theorists, it can be mapped uniquely on a string, where the parentheses represent base pairs. So for instance, this base pair here is this parenthesis, violet here, violet here. And these base pairs follow the mathematical notation, so I don't need coloring. If I write down such a string, I can deduce the cover leaf structure in this case here. What is the rule? Well, you look for the structure of minimum free energy. There are many other suboptimal structures for RNA. They're the same as in proteins. You have a real spectrum of conformations, and the spectrum of conformations is now one of the topics that's studied experimentally and also in structure prediction. Now, what base are the base pairing rules? And when can I make a parenthesis? And this is AUCGGUA. It's like what's in Greek, and as I said already, the GU wobble pair also fits into the RNA structure, so we have more base pairs here. Here you see one example. The strand goes down here, the strand goes up here, and as it happens in filin-alanyl tRNA, there is also a GU base pair that you can see here. And there's one immediate conclusion that you can draw, and which is relevant for RNA structures. You have 4 to the nth power different sequences. You have a 4-letter alphabet. There are different letters in here in the single-stranded parts, which are modified bases, and which I will come to in a second. And here, the number of structures is definitely less. It's actually much smaller than 3 to the n's, because it's a 3-letter alphabet, and I have restrictions. I cannot combine parentheses at will. So I have to fulfill the mathematical relations. So that means we have many more sequences than structures, and this is what people found out empirically, and I will show you. You can also design an algorithm that allows you to compute for a given structure thousands of sequences if it's a common structure. This is our sequence, and we want to design a tRNA molecule without these modified bases. Now this here, you see, this is the structure that we have seen already, and the modifications that you see here, D is dihydro-U, M is a methylated guanine, Y is a so-called Y base, and so on. So you see number of modifications, and they are required to form the correct structure. And here you see the free energy is minus 20 kilocalories per mole in this case. Now, we have the unmodified molecule. We take out the modified bases, fold it with a folding algorithm, and get a completely different structure. So this is not the structure we want to have. So we want to design it to become the correct structure. Just to show you, you get a delta G of minus 22.9 kilocalories per mole. And if I force the molecule to fold on the desired structure, the clover leaf, I get a lower, a higher free energy. That means in absolute value, it's smaller, only 21.9. Now, I have here these stacks. And I want to force the stacks to fold into proper double helices. So what I might do is, for instance, I do GC, GC, GC everywhere I have such a stack, and then I hope they are now forced to fold onto each other. GC is very strong, so I would expect to get the clover leaf now. No, unsuccessful. We can check. What we get is 43 kilocalories per mole, because we have many more GCs, it's much more stable, and the correct structure lies way above in the spectrum of suboptimals. So this was not a successful trial to construct. Now, we might say I use here GC, 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 and here I use a different pattern. So this is only going to fold on that. This is only going to fold on that. This is only going to fold on that. Okay? No. Again, unsuccessful. It's not great fun. You see? And the difference is again huge. So the desired structure is not here. Now, what else could we do? Now, for instance, we could throw out the G's and the C's in this regions here, and have only A's and U's in the single-stranded regions, make the stacks as strong as possible. A second try, it's a little bit better already. We have a clover leaf, but if we look now, our clover leaf, this is not the correct clover leaf. The target structure is still different, and we see it's not as large as this was. We see already a difference. Now, the last thing that we can do is we throw out all the U's and make it to A's and see what's going to happen. So this is now this structure, and now you can guess it has no chance but to fold on the correct structure. And of course, then we get that it's really the minimum free energy structure. Now, this is brute force design, where you don't need anything sophisticated. You just try with paper and pencil to design. Now, you can do better. And as a matter of fact, we have developed in the early 90s an inverse folding algorithm where, given a structure, we can compute the sequences which fold into the structure. And this is an iterative procedure. You start with an initial trial sequence, and you mutate this initial sequence until you get the target sequence that gives you the target structure. Works very well, this inverse folding algorithm. But it may also happen that you have unsuccessful trials, then you stop after a while the algorithm. So, if you are interested in this whole area, predicting secondary structures, inverse folding, and also what we have done is define formal spaces, conformation space, sequence space, and also Favolution, a shape space, structure space, and this has been summarized recently in a review article in reports on progress in physics. I come to my next point, evolution and optimization of molecule. This is a work that I have started together with Walter Fontana and then developed for quite a while. What we wanted to see is whether or not it's possible, if you start with some random sequence giving you a random structure, to evolve it towards a given target structure, and this target structure has been chosen again, the phenylalanine tRNA, because this is so well known and it's a more complicated structure that's not so easy to get. So this is the paper where we have done the first detailed simulation on it. So in essence, what we simulate is such a reaction mixture, and we define a replication rate constant which allows us to converge towards the structure as stiff as possible by the structure of sequence space. And this is the result, what you get for a single trajectory. You have phases of fast approach towards the target structure. This is the distance from the target structure. And then you have plateaus. You have long plateaus where there is no progress in the approach towards the target structure. And what you see is there are short plateaus, there are long plateaus. What we did not see is that the plateaus become longer and longer the closer you come the target structure, to your final solution. And this reflects the structure of the search space. So you can also have search spaces where these plateaus become longer and longer, but they are not the ones which are there in which we have with biopolymers. Now, this quasi-stationary epoch, we might be interested what's going to happen on this quasi-stationary epoch, and here I have chosen one where we have a very long trajectory. And this is the initial sequence that forms structure number 9, as you can see here. This is the dominant structure in the population then for some while. And this is the transition-inducing mutation. This is the other transition-inducing mutation. And then what's happening is neutral mutations are accumulated on this plateau. So on the plateau, the population accumulates neutral mutations. And in this case, it's 28 neutral point mutations out from a molecule that's 76 bases long. So this is really a long quasi-stationary phase of the evolution. And what's happening is the population searches sequence based by kind of random walk. And when it finds a better solution, it can optimize further. And on these long plateaus, it's very hard to find one of these solutions. So this is just to show you a few pictures how the final structure is formed. You make multi-loops at first, and you merge multi-loops, and you get the final structure. And the sketch of this optimization on the neutral networks can be done as the following. You start somewhere, you optimize, then you come on such a neutral network and do a random walk until you find the possibility with one point mutation to go to the next neutral network. Again, you do a random walk until you find the target. People who have done experimental work in this area, they also find these vast neutral sets. I just want to mention the work, experimental work with RNA molecules goes back to the 60s when the late Saul Spiegelman with his co-workers did the first extracellular Darwinian experiments, as he called it. And, until the last paper, which has shown certain improvements, is 97, so this is quite some time, and now one understands how these systems work. This is the old Spiegelman experiment that everybody can repeat if he wants. If he knows a little biochemistry, he has no problem in doing that. So you have a serial transfer. You put an RNA sample into a solution that sustains replication. Then after a while, you transfer small quantities. And in that way, you have a similar situation as in this continuous reactor that I have shown you. It has also been used for practical purposes to design molecules all kinds of uses to design it, and this is just the people. The principle is you amplify, which is easy nowadays. DNA you can amplify with TAC polymerase. RNA, you have a whole collection of enzymes that you can use, everyone with special properties. You cause genetic diversity either by high replication rates, or alternatively, you can also insert random stretches in the molecules. Both has been done, both works well. Then the trick is you have to have a selection procedure. And this is the real challenge. You have to find a way to select the proper molecules. But what the people do is like the animal breeders. They pick out, for instance, the brown kitten and do away with the black ones if they want to get brown ones. But this has to be done with molecules. And this is the real trick. This is one example which I find very impressive. This is one short RNA molecule that gives a hairpin structure with a single bulge here. And it binds the molecule topramycin with a dissociation constant of 9 nanomolar. So this is indeed very strong, and this is among the strongest what you find in nature. So with a simple lab experiment, you can actually do recognition, development of recognition between molecules with the rate constant, equilibrium constant that you find in nature. And this is just the size distribution. This is the RNA, and this is this antibiotic sugar amino glucoside antibiotic that you see here. So the RNA molecules are pretty big. What you actually, if you see only the letters, you have to remember that there is the whole backbone, which is much larger molecule than it looks. And it has also been done with proteins. In a recent, very beautiful written review, Jäger, Karsten, Hilbert from the ETH Zurich on protein design by directed evolution, they have shown how to include translation and to evolve proteins. So you can design proteins. And these are two books, a couple of years now, old, which deal with proteins and with RNA molecules developed as aptamers. And just to give you an update, artificial evolution is used for proteins, for RNA molecules, as I said already previously, and then in a recent work, chemical evolution, doing combinatorial chemistry and selection in a very tricky way, is also done with the basis of attachment to nucleic acid and evolution. Well, what are the results of this chapter? Evolutionary optimization does not require cells and occurs in molecular systems as well. In vitro evolution allows for production of molecules with predefined purposes and gave rise to a modern branch of biotechnology. And then I did not really go into that because it's a different story. Direct evidence that neutrality is a major factor for the success of evolution, I tried to convince you by looking on these various examples of neutral networks which were necessary to find the RNA. I will say a few words on origin of biological complexity. How much time do I have, Lynn? Okay, good. Then, so I will make this story short because you know it. This is the basic features of reactions in the cell. You have metabolism providing all the ingredients. Then we have a three-dimensional structure which shows the regulation of genes on the DNA. And this is just a sketch of a small genetic and metabolic network which we use in model simulations. And you can analyze networks of this type in great detail. We have done some work on that with two gene systems and higher gene systems. However, this is the real problem. And then is where all this analytic approach, you perhaps know the Boehringer, actually I see that's a mistake, it was Boehringer Mannheim that published this chart. And to show you how complicated that is, this is a magnification of a detail out of it, which happens to be the citrate cycle here. So this is one problem. And the next problem I want to show you here. This is a bacterial genome. We have 4 million nucleotides, about 4,400 genes. And that's what the bacterium looks like in a drawing according to electron microscopy. When I did my biochemistry course in the late 50s, early 60s, we were told bacteria are plastic bags and the molecules swim freely in here. And for that reason, you can apply chemical kinetics to study biochemical reactions. Now, this is what it looks in reality. And I believe that the future theory on a reaction taking place in such an environment will have to look different than the differential equations. But this is a tradition since Newton, and the methods have been developed so nicely that for good reasons, scientists apply differential equations over and over again. Now this is somebody who is not quoted so often, but he had one of the most important views on biology, that for all higher organisms you have the germline and you have the somatic cells that are separated, and so you get the development. And I just sketch here for you presumably the best understood part of development by biochemical modeling, which is the development of the fruit fly Drosophila, where I think these cascades of genetic control are now already more or less well understood. So we come to the complexity. This is genome length with 4 million nucleotides, and what you get is, it's like a book, 4 books, 300 pages each, is a polygenome, and what you get is this. And now we come to man. This is 3 × 10⁻¹. It's almost a factor 10^3 more. We have 200 different cell types. Of course, Escherichia coli is only one cell type. The number of genes is approximately 30,000. And this corresponds to a library of 3,000 volumes with 300 pages. And that's what you need to get out somebody like this guy here. I think many of them will know him. It's Ludwig Boltzmann in his young years. Now this is an interesting a comparison for measures of complexity in nature. And for primitive organisms, the amount of DNA, the number of base pairs, is not too bad. It increases with our feeling how these organisms become more complex. But then it levels off. And then the number of cell types is a good measure. Between the lower vertebrates and mammals, primates, humans, it starts to level off. We have practically the same number of cell types as the higher apes have. There is no difference. But then the relative brain mass is often used as an example, and it's called cultural drive. So if you go in the complexity from the higher vertebrates up to man, you see this enormous increase in brain mass. And there is a funny thing that between the elephant and the apes, the great apes, you see the songbirds. And how do you know that songbirds are intelligent? And there is an example, often quoted, the British did. I don't know whether it's true or not. But this British did learned and spread the culture of opening milk bottles in no time over the whole United Kingdom. So that's what people tell me. If you have your bottle outside and the tits are around, they know how to open it and then they will drink it. So you need to have a different stopper or something like that. Okay, now there's one thing that makes, as I believe and many believe, nature so complex, and this has been precisely formulated by François Jacob in a nice booklet containing 3 lectures, The Possible and the Actual, and this is about evolution and tinkering. Evolution does not design with the eyes of an engineer. It just uses what's there and puts it together. And I have one example which is an example from yeast. Saccharomyces cerevisiae had a gene duplication in the past, and there is another related organism that did not go through this gene duplication. Then, as a result of the gene duplication, most of the genes were eliminated, except two. There are 2 new ones here in this sketch, and what you can see, the order of the genes, the sequence, has been completely changed by that, because the gene eliminated in the first or in the second copy was quite irregular. So this is one thing, and the other thing is you would not expect in Nature 2006 to find an article, what's a gene? because everybody assumes since Mendel, people talk about genes and they named the genes at the turn to the 20th century, and now they are asking in the 21st century what's a gene. And the reason for that is that messenger RNA, before it's translated, is processed, changed, manipulated in the cells. And it turns out now that many proteins come from the same piece of DNA, but have different amino acid sequences in different tissues of the body. So now, what is a gene? If you say it's a piece of DNA that gives rise to a protein, it holds no longer. It's more insight that we have nowadays, and this is also the reason why people are completely uncertain to tell you the number of genes for a human, and say about 30,000, because it's not known for every protein. The situation is even worse in case of transcription of the genome. You all will remember a correct statement that of the human genome, only 5% is translated into protein. This is correct, and this has been worked out already in the 90s. And there's nothing changed about that. However, the rest of the DNA was considered junk DNA, not being processed by the organism. And this turns out to be wrong. In the ENCODE project, this is an encyclopedia of DNA elements, a consortium, a huge consortium, has started to look on every piece of DNA, human DNA, and to see whether it's transcribed or not. And what they found is not 5% are transcribed, more than 90% are transcribed. And the difference between 5 and 95 are RNA molecules. Nobody knows what all these RNA molecules are doing. We have some examples how they are involved in epigenetics. So this is just to say one should be prepared for further surprises in this area. And I will close here, biology and complexity, by saying evolution does not design with the eyes of an engineer, but uses available objects for new purposes, tinkering and bricolage, I have mentioned. And the increase of complexity in biological evolution, I would say, it's an empirical fact. It's not so easy to deduce from first principles here, but it's something that we actually should be aware of. Now, if you give me a little more, I make this transition to the proteins a little more time. And actually, this is the old question of probabilities in biology. And my example is the myoglobin molecule. It's a polymer chain of 153 amino acids with the sequence. Here you see the sequence, and here you see the structure. And one of the questions is, I start with some arbitrary amino acid sequence. What's the probability that I can develop in an evolutionary process a myoglobin molecule? And there is an old argument by Eugene Wigner, what Fred Hoyle has phrased into a much more popular scenario. What Fred says is, I have a jumbo jet, a large airplane, and it is taken apart, and all the parts lie on the runway. And then a tornado comes, and when the tornado went through, the airplane stays there. So the tornado, by whirling all these parts among each other, has assembled the airplane. What's the probability for such an event? And this probability is zero for all practical purposes. And the argument that I would like to use here is that what they have said is all sequences have equal probability. All arrangements of these parts have equal probability, except only one is the one I want to have. All the others are listen. I don't consider them as having some function. And then you can do the calculation for the myoglobin molecule. You have an alphabet size of 20, 153 amino acids, then 20 to the 153 is 0.11 times 10 to the 200, and the probability to find, by this procedure, a myoglobin sequence is a zero, and then 200, precisely 199 zeros and a 9 at the end. So you can say that's less than nothing, because if you can't have such numbers in the universe. But my argument is, they have just done an extreme estimate, which is completely unrealistic. I do another estimate. It's also completely unrealistic, but it goes with different arguments. Every single point mutation towards the target sequence leads to an improvement and is therefore selected. This is the sequence we want to get. So I tried hard to start with one sequence that has no letter in common. And then, whenever I change a letter like here, and it leads to something which is not identical with the sequence I discarded. When it has a proper change like this one here, I keep it. And I go on. And this is simple calculation. Finally, I will get every correct letter is changed into red and selected. I can do the calculation. I get the probability to get the sequence of 0000034. This is a huge probability. This is much larger than in the lottery. Orders of magnitude larger in the lottery. So, and I just use this example to show that this probability argument is completely off the point. This is not correct, and the other one is not correct either. And I end by just showing you a case where we have the answer now, which is a similar problem, the so-called Levinthal paradox, the folding problem of the myoglobin molecule. I get with an estimate, and it doesn't matter this number precisely, about 10 to the 180 conformations. And what Levinthal said is, how can a protein manage to find this conformation, which is 1 out of 10 to 120. And the answer is formulated here in three basic questions. What's the folding code? What's the folding mechanism? And finally, we would like to predict. This is out of a recent paper on the protein folding, a recent review on the protein folding problem. Now, the best illustration is done by means of this diagram. This is the Fred Hoyle surface, and now imagine there is a blind golf player standing at the periphery of the golf place and throwing the ball. What's his chance to find the hole? Zero. Well, he doesn't even know the direction, so he may throw it off this circle here. And if this is large enough, he has no chance to find. What about this surface? If he stands here, and if he hits towards the funnel, the ball will always run and find the target. So this is the other extreme situation. So here, you have about 50%. If the blind golf player hits the ball and goes off the funnel, then it doesn't find the player. But otherwise, it would find the minimum. So these are the true extreme cases where you get these unrealistic probabilities. And as a matter of fact, there are a few proteins, like ribonuclease A, where you have a situation which comes close to the funnel, where you have easy folding, and whenever you start from any random conformation, you come to the thermodynamically stable structure, and you form the disulfide bonds where you need them. And this is the more realistic picture drawn by Peter Wolines, Jose Onucic, and others, where you have many intermediates in between. And this is a picture by Ken Dill, which shows such a complicated funnel. And as a matter of fact, there is one by Chris Dobson, And Cesari and Martin Kaplan, they have reconstructed for lysozyme the way to fold. There are easy trajectories like the yellow one. There are more difficult ones like the green one, and the red one is one which takes more time. But in this case, almost all trajectories follow properly. And the nice thing is that we have data now where you can see how the folding takes place. It starts with different initial small secondary structure element proceeds, and finally comes to the structure. This is G protein, and this is a case of RNA where we see the same principle. Small pieces form small secondary structure elements, then assemble the secondary structure, and finally come to the tertiary structure. And here are some additional examples. Now, with this, I think I have tried to span the bridge towards the topic, or at least close to the topic of this conference. And if you're interested, my lecture will be on the webpage by the end of this week. Thank you very much.
It's all good. I say let's take over the last few minutes and have a few questions if possible. So, anybody want to
I've been doing your RNA design work, and you showed you could get the secondary structure design. But will that fold up into the tertiary structure?
Yeah. Now, the secondary structure design is fairly simple because the number of motifs is very limited, and so it's easier to design an algorithm. What the algorithm actually does, it keeps all the correct parts and tries to add parts which are not correct in the structure. It's a kind of looking and local module. Now, if you have a full list of tertiary structures, what you will be able to do is to do the forward problem. So you have a given secondary structure, you have a given sequence, and then you can find the tertiary structure motifs. There are perhaps 40, 50 or something like that, and you can predict. Let's assume that this prediction is fairly correct already. Then, in order to design an inverse algorithm, you have to find a way to run the forward algorithm in such a way that it comes closer and closer to the result. Not impossible, but since we don't have the forward problem solved yet, makes no sense to try to develop it. This is a general feature of inverse problems. You have to be able to treat the forward problem with sufficient accuracy, then it would work. I am not skeptic if the forward problem is solved, that you can do this design algorithms. For small parts of the molecule can be done already, but not for large RNAs.
Although in proteins, you find that perhaps it's going to be easier to make designs rather than to do the predictions. So maybe we'll take a leap ahead.
Yeah, this is when you do it by inside and by human intervention. Then I believe it's sometimes easier to do the design. If you do it algorithmically, then you have to know your forward problem. This is a general general for all inverse problems.
Well, can you go back to one of the pictures you were showing about the RNA folding, where there were brackets, colored brackets, and there was a nested structure?
Yeah.
Now, my question about that is, looking at that, it seems there is some kind of grammar or logical structure. I mean, if you have got nested brackets, and you were referring these two as constraints, like in the case of secondary structure, you have got the complementary, the quick Watson, and the other case, the free energy, when you go to the tertiary structure. So. Yeah. My question is, do you see, or do you know, anybody looked from the point of view of the formal linguistic structure. For instance, I know the David Saul had done long time ago, but not in this context. Because when you go from linear to the secondary to the tertiary structure, looking at your brackets, which I saw, it reminds me of logic, you know, where you have got, they call it well-formed formulas. That means you can form them only in specific ways, but not in other ways. So I wonder if you have thought about this or you look that there is some kind of logical structure in
there. Now, the secondary structure, as I was showing it, is constructed in such a way that you don't need the colors for the bracket notation. It's mathematical notation. It's uniquely defined. However, there are structures containing so-called pseudonodes. And then you need the colors, because then the brackets do not form mathematical notation, and they can fall into each other. The logic in this case is fairly simple of folding. You have a criterion, and this is minimizing free energy. But the logic of folding is not difficult at all for this simple case. And the reason why it's simple is you draw your clover leaf structure and complicated secondary structures. However, they are all one-dimensional objects. So what you do is you go from the sequence, which is a one-dimensional string, to the secondary structure, which you can draw as a kind of a two-dimensional object, but it's still the complexity of a string that you have, because you can map it on the string. When it goes then to tertiary interactions, it becomes more complex, because then you cannot map it on a string anymore. You get these additional interactions, and the objects are more complex. And in the moment, the people are not so much looking for a logic. This will come later. What the people now is they collect motifs. They collect structures which they can relate to the sequences. Lambda calculus, yeah.
That's a computational aspect of
yeah,
the model.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was thinking that
term. Lambda calculus was not used for the structures. It was used for chemical kinetics and kind of a formal set of chemical kinetics. Meanwhile, other people have produced other sets like this. Now, this lambda is much more complex than the logic of secondary structure formation. When it comes to the 3D formation, then you need a more elaborate logic. But in the moment, people are just collecting empirical data.
I wanted to thank you for a beautiful overview of many important problems in biology. I had a question about your comment on the finite RNA motifs. You mentioned there are 30 known, and likely there is a finite number, and therefore we can predict tertiary structures. There seems to be a controversy right now in connection with structural genomics and protein, the protein structural genomics initiative, where some people claim that the number of motifs is infinite. So I'm wondering if you can comment on this. I mean, it's not a requirement that the number of motifs be finite in order for us to predict RNA structure. So could you comment on this finite infinite dilemma?
Now, it always depends on how accurate you want to predict. With proteins, you have the problem that there is no natural way of discretization. If you want to have discrete structures, you have to define them in some way. With RNA, you get the discrete structure because what you see is two nucleotides either form a base pair or they don't. So there is no intermediate range. When they don't form a base pair, they are rather far apart, and when they come at a certain distance and the structure allows, they form a base pair. So this is a yes or no logic. There are additional motifs like base triplets, like the G quartets, And what we don't know is whether they build an infinite number of more complex motifs. However, the situation gets more and more restrictive for RNA molecules of a certain size. For instance, to have one G quartet in a structure is already a structural restriction which only certain structures can make. And if you build on that and make it more and more complex, they will have very, very low probability. It's nevertheless important for the statement, is it finite or not finite, but if it's infinite, for sure there will be some higher motifs that occur only once in a certain structure, very rarely. And in this case, what the people say, a motif has to be transferable. So it has to be found in several structures before it becomes a motif. With building the tertiary structure with such motifs, you do not precisely build every fine detail, because that depends on sequences and so on. But you get the overall picture, like the people in the protein fold. I think you can get this very well. And I personally believe that for RNA you have a finite number. I also would say that for proteins this is a much more subtle question.
All right, great. Let's thank the speaker one more time. Thank you.